Hello.
And welcome back to a rainy, cold day on This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
I say let's get through the intro pretty fast because we have
a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. We're hitting episode 143, I believe. Yes. And it begins a two-parter.
Yeah.
Well, four-parter if you count your part, then my part, then my part, then your part.
So when this is coming out, it's Halloween. So happy Halloween to everyone who celebrates. Yes. Which is mostly Americans as far as I've heard. Mm-hmm. But hey, Americans love a good time to have or a great time to have a good time. So
we just need an excuse, really. Yeah.
So we'll take it. Which means that we're both doing a Halloween themed episode because how could we miss the opportunity to do that? Will you do the honors? We talked a little bit about it last week.
We're talking about the witches today.
Witches! So I am tackling the European witch trials, and Kat is doing American.
Yes.
So.
And we'll be doing the beginning, essentially, of both of our topics.
Yeah, so today will be the beginning. Next week will be kind of the wrap up for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gonna be a great time.
It's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So stick around and find out why this is not.
This is not a history lecture. With Kat and Kaylee.
Okay, before we get in, jump into our actual topics, we do need to spend some time talking about world events, specifically the situation that's happening in Gaza right now.
Mm-hmm.
The situation has unfortunately escalated from the last time we talked about it, which was 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, we're recording this on October 29th, and the last 2 days have been particularly dangerous with Israel essentially cutting off all communications from Gaza to the outside world, and then introducing basically carpet bombing tactics in regions of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And no matter who you think is in the right or wrong, that is a blatant violation of every human right.
Yeah. It's also literally a war crime.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. It has been since the Geneva Convention. Yes. And it should just morally be abhorrent to anyone.
Yes.
Carpet bombing is, I had this discussion, we had it in our Japan class too, that carpet bombing, if you look at statistics and figures, kills, is one of the most effective ways to just kill people.
Yeah.
In mass.
So Israel has, for basically all of its existence, been an apartheid state with Muslims and Palestinians existing essentially in an apartheid state. And it's clear now that the actions they're taking is that they want to end that apartheid state by either forcing Palestinians to completely move out of their ancestral homelands. And if they don't, they're going to kill them. And they're doing this all under the guise of, Hamas is attacking us, so we have the right to do this.
Mm. Which we would like to remind everyone that an organization, non-government organization, does not always represent the people, nor does a government always represent the people and their wishes either. We don't want to, demonize every single person in Israel.
I will say, and then the American government has a very large hand in this,
a lot of Americans do not support this.
There's active
protests going on all around the world,
all over the world, because almost every Western government is, except Ireland, which God bless, but
Ireland's really just their own. Well, also we can talk about that today because that's a notable thing in the witch trials too. Ireland's usually the more chill one, which is ironic because it's Ireland.
God, I respect them so much. Anyway, it's clear that Western powers want a foothold in the Middle Eastern region for
the history of the last 70 years,
a lot of different reasons, and they are willing to allow thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people to die for that.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that's not what we stand for, even though it seems to be what our government stands for. So it is Sorry, my cat is wanting to contribute to the conversation. Regardless, the acts that the Israeli government is taking, that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces are taking against the people in Gaza, is essentially an act of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
They are killing indiscriminately a population that they have segmented off for religious and ethnic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a genocide.
Yeah.
And they are doing it under the excuse, the very loosely veiled excuse, and anyone who semi pays attention knows that the actions Hamas has done does not deserve 8,000 Palestinian civilians dying in indiscriminate carpet bombing because of it. There's also been reports of the use of white phosphorus.
I did hear that.
Yep. Which is another war crime.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are engaging in is essentially collective punishment on the people of Gaza, specifically the northern part of Gaza.
Which is also a violation of
A literal violation of, like, the actual human rights. And is, again, another war crime. And we're getting to the point now where people are finally starting to admit, hey, something's going on. We have to stop this.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very painfully slowly. Too slowly. There are still thousands of people dying while they're taking their time. Fortunately, the UN Secretary, is that his title? Secretary General?
I think he's Secretary General. Are you talking about... Yes. Yeah. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, he issued a statement condemning Israel, which...
is huge.
Which is like, a really, really, really big deal. For the UN
to condemn what you are doing,
yeah.
For the United Nations, one of the most paid attention to authorities on topics like this, to condemn you have to F up.
Yeah.
So badly.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, like, over 8,000 people are dead. 8,000 people is just the official death count as of now.
They have not even... They're nowhere close to having removed bodies and
not to mention that there is very limited power, if any. Hospitals are running out of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have 8,000 people dead, the number that are injured from those bombings is countless.
And the amount of people that are going to die from disease,
mm-hmm.
and as human bodies are not treated properly after death, that is going to spur and I've heard a lot of people talking about this, that at this point, it is no longer just about who is actively dead right now. It's the... there is no way to get humanitarian aid in there at this scale that will diminish what is about to happen as the fallout from this.
Yeah.
There will not be a way to get these people medicine quickly enough. Thousands and thousands more are going to die. Regardless of what you do.
Yeah.
And I think that as we analyze this, because, you know, you can listen and tap into any current events podcast and listen to them talk about this. But our take on this is kind of with the consideration of history in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And... it is hard, like, to watch this. And I know a lot of people have had that discourse lately, too, about, like, oh, if it's becoming too much, remove yourself from it. Like,
yeah.
But if you look at history and how history works, a lot of the time people, and at the risk of doing the ad Hitlerum thing where, you know, you compare anything to the Holocaust, like, victims of... yes, the Holocaust, but genocides in general and horrific human events, they oftentimes say that they know the civilian on the street can't do anything, but what they want is someone to witness it and learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
and not to mention, like, people who are committing genocides take advantage of the fact that they know that the average person cannot
stomach. Do anything.
And it becomes overwhelming, and they're just going to look away eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're waiting for that.
Yeah, and that's when really... things take a turn for the worse.
Yeah. And so, like, through the historic standpoint, we just...
yeah.
And we can't go into a full in-depth history of everything that has happened over the last 100 years since... I mean, especially since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It's messy and it's confusing. There are some really good crash courses. I mean, even John Green has a crash course on this topic. And it's pretty good. I did rewatch it the other day to make sure that I was getting the very basics of everything.
Right.
But from a historic standpoint, there's a lot repeating itself here that it's it's important to consider history and not just intake what's happening now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, because this has been clearly something that has been building for a long time. And to me, it looks like Israel was kind of looking for any excuse.
Mm-hmm.
And this excuse was good enough as any. And now we're seeing thousands and thousands of civilians dead. And this is a place where 47 was the number. 47% of the population is below 18 in Gaza. And so that means of the 8,000 that we know have confirmed dead, about half are children.
Yeah.
From bombing. And
that's an undeniable, like, that was you can't look at that and tell me that the attackers, the Israeli government, was like, yeah, this is a good idea. This is for Hamas. This is not, that was not about
Hamas.
And
to be very clear, they are not planning on backing down at any point. In fact, Netanyahu just issued a statement saying, oh, we're about to start phase two, which if that was phase one, Jesus Christ, what are we doing? Yeah. So it's important to, as you said, basically not look away, even if that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Is just watch and listen and hear from the people. And if you can share their stories, fantastic. If you can donate, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But even all they're asking at the end of the day is just to be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Because we cannot let this occur the same way that other things like this have occurred in just total silence.
And there's that conversation, too, about generational experiences.
Mm-hmm.
About, like, and who's the author? There's a very prominent, I feel bad for not remembering his name. There's a very prominent author who survived the Holocaust who talked about that. That he's like, what happens when our generation is gone and people aren't paying attention to it anymore? The people who are still alive have never witnessed it on that scale.
Right.
And he talked a lot about, like, generational trauma and how in some ways it prevents it, but if no one else is paying attention and no one is watching, what does that change? So if the least we can do is witness it and make sure that we understand human value and how to pass that on and try and shape politics to be better and the world to be better, you know, what do we pull out of that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
We just perpetuate a cycle.
Right. At some point, hopefully, you know, we'll be able to pay enough attention that these things won't happen on a scale like this anymore. But unfortunately,
that's not today, I guess.
Yeah. And it's really, really hard. It's been really scary to watch everything, especially the few days. I think as of last night, they have internet access again in Gaza, which is fantastic. But for the, I think it was not quite 2 days, but close to it, when they cut off everything and started bombing and seeing the videos of people outside of Gaza filming it from Egypt, and you can just see bombs lighting up the night sky. Like, it's, and when you cut off communication access, you're cutting it off not just with the outside world, but with the people inside the area too. So it's so they can't talk to each other either, and it was really, really, really hard. But again, it has to be hard because these are people dying, you know. And yeah, so unfortunately there's nothing we can do really, but other than like sit in this moment and do the things that we can do. And you know, if you're able to go join a protest, join a protest. If you're able to call your representative, call your representative.
If it comes down to like teaching your children, your future children, the friends around you, like
having conversations with friends and helping them understand the situation of what's happening there.
Human empathy is very easily lost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's restored by our ability to talk about things, to communicate. And that's very important.
Yeah. So we just wanted to take this time to talk about what's happening in Gaza. Because, as I said, unfortunately, if you are familiar with the history, you know that this has been building for a while. And this was always a risk. And Palestine should have been free decades ago. And it's very upsetting that this is what it took to kind of bring international attention to what exactly was happening there. Mm-hmm. And it's too early to say if it's too late.
Yeah. Right. Well, and that's the hard part about being historians in a current time is we talked about this when Russia and Ukraine first invaded Ukraine. It's mm-hmm. it's impossible as a historian to say like exactly where something is going, if mm-hmm. history is going to directly repeat itself. Mm-hmm. But we would be remiss as historians to not document things as they're happening in our lives, because it informs mm-hmm. our lives. It informs what we talk about, how we experience things. Mm-hmm. We are, in a way, in many ways, a secondary source that people are going to look back at someday and study our historiography, how right. we talk about events. You and me, right. two mid-20s
right.
people in yeah. 2000 and whatever year it is. Like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
So.
Right. And we're American, so it's like, what were our perspectives on it and everything? And
yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's a really valuable source. That's yeah. like one of those sources as a historian, you're like, oh, this is amazing.
Right. Well,
yeah.
we are two, I like to think, relatively progressive
yeah.
Yeah. white people in their yeah. mid-20s in right. a very conservative part of Texas. And mm-hmm. we actively do things that yeah. put us, like, and honestly, in some ways, at risk where we live, where yeah. we work and stuff. We yeah. talk about things in a way that's not always accepted.
Yeah.
So
in line with maybe what our employers would think.
Yeah.
My conscience would never allow me right. to, like, if I get fired for saying what I believe is right,
right.
for speaking out against a genocide, so fucking be it.
Right. Like, right. Right. And the sad thing is that
yeah.
The places we work and mm-hmm. the people we are around, there are cases where that is a possibility.
I know.
And that is terrifying. But, yeah. and you don't think of that in America, but that's our duty as history people, as mm-hmm. as advocates, like,
yeah,
and it is like, you're right, it is the least we can do. Without it, my conscience would be
yeah.
So that's why we talk about this stuff sometimes. Mm-hmm. I know it probably sounds like a little bit of fan service, but we really do care about these issues in so many ways.
Yeah, and it's important to use what small platform any of us have to kind of, again, have these conversations. And if anything, just remember what exactly is happening there. I would encourage everyone to, because news sources, as we've talked about before, always have a tilt. Mm-hmm. But there are, especially now that the internet is coming back, there is a lot of primary sources happening and coming mm-hmm. out of Gaza that is pretty undeniable evidence of what's happening there.
Yeah.
And it's very different when you... My other cat wants to join in too. It's pretty different when, you know, you can see the videos of, and there are some really, really rough images.
And we're not asking you to like look at graphic material or anything like that. But like, if you're not sure what news sources to trust, mm-hmm. trust the people who are currently
on the ground,
in it.
Boots on the ground, showing you
yeah,
what is happening there. And that's a primary source, and there's not much more reliable than a primary source.
Correct.
You know, they can be, you know, sometimes misconstrued, but when you have this many people reporting on the same information directly, mm-hmm.
it's a much more probable, safe way to go.
Mm-hmm. And we just, you know, it feels silly to say this, but like, our thoughts are with everyone currently in Gaza. They are, I know, on my mind, and they have been pretty much constantly for the last few days. And
yeah,
so yeah, it's hard when you feel kind of useless to keep caring, because it's just human to want to kind of check out of it and be like, well, there's nothing I can do.
Yeah,
but again,
that only allows perpetrators to keep doing mm-hmm. it. So
we can't.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's
our take on what's happening right now.
Yeah.
And we'll keep bringing you all kinds of history. But if there is something, like I said, we can't conquer that. But if there ever is something that you're like, hey, this piece of history or this thing going on the entirely other side of the world, because like you said, this was not, a lot of people weren't paying attention to this. And to be fair, like, it's not something I openly advocated for. I wasn't like constantly talking about what's going on in the Gaza Strip. Like I knew what was going on, but it's like it hadn't escalated to the point where I thought I needed to be openly advocating. Right. But that you're in a lot of ways that allows this stuff to happen. So if there's ever stuff that y'all want to hear or learn about that we can take a manageable bite-sized chunk out of and present to you through a historic lens, let us know. Like seriously, we've covered some pretty big topics on this show. We usually avoid the ones that are going to take 20 episodes to do because there are podcasts that entirely dedicate themselves to those things.
Yep.
But if there's something that you want our take on, please let us know.
And we'll do our best. And so with all of that being said,
we've got some totally radically different history.
We've got some other stuff,
but it does involve persecution of people. So
speaking of topics that we can't spend 20 episodes on because there are entire podcasts dedicating to it, we're talking about the witch trials today.
Yeah, and we're doing a nice, easy, condensed version.
Yep.
And actually today, Kaylee's going to go first because of how our timing on this works out.
Yeah, how the timelines worked. So this worked better that I get us started. And how I'm going to do this, because I, as we talked about, like I have the European...
I just have to acknowledge that Appa, for the first time ever, willingly got on my lap and is gone. Okay. Well.
Yeah. He's, you know, his love is fleeting. No, he's over here because he's convinced that even though he gets fed at 5 p.m., at about 2:30, he gets to start asking to be fed. My animals are, as you all know, it's very particularly special. So how I'm going to do this is I'm going to kind of like take it through a rough timeline and kind of give a general overview of how it started, how it ended up where it was. And then I'm going to do one pretty good case study of an actual witch trial that took place during kind of the height of the craze. And then I'm going to leave that off today and we're going to pick up next week with kind of the rest of the height of the craze and then kind of like the aftermath and how it faded off and the effects and everything like that. So just as an overview, just to what to expect on here, because it is for me and maybe for you too, it's much more of a cultural history and other than like an event, like this happened and then this happened and then this happened.
When something spans so long,
it
informs like, because the American side of it, it's in a tighter period of time. So I can be like, this happened this day.
Yeah, it's much more of like an event with yours. Yeah, yeah. This is like hundreds of years of history that I'm doing here. So we're going to get it done. And yeah. So... What are witches exactly? Most witches in the historic conception are primarily women, but they can be men too. Basically people doing the quote devil's work and that are in league with the devil. And by them being in league with the devil, this grants them certain supernatural abilities, such as being able to like curse people and, you know, fly and have like a familiar and all of those kind of classic witch tropes, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. The sort of stereotype kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So witches have been like the concept of witches have been kind of around essentially since biblical times. One of the earliest records we have of a witch, as we would now call it, is in the Bible itself in 1 Samuel, which is thought to be written between 931 BC and 721 BC, which is the story of
King Saul.
King Saul sought the witch of Endor to summon the dead prophet Samuel's spirit to help him defeat the Philistine army. The witch then prophesies the death of Saul and his sons. And then the next day, Saul's sons die in battle, and Saul commits suicide. So this is kind of the first historic record of a witch.
I can't remember if the Philistines won that war or not.
Hey, me neither.
I feel like they probably did at that point.
Yeah, it doesn't sound
too
promising.
It's been a while since I went back into the Samuels to read.
Yeah. There are some other points in the Old Testament that the witches are mentioned. One of them that's most often cited is Exodus 22:18, which says, quote, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Other stuff in the Bible that kind of hints towards witches and witchcraft is passages that caution against the use of divination, chanting, or using witches to contact the dead. So the Bible is generally anti-witch, but it doesn't seem like it's that hot of a topic.
Well, it's kind of like how that discussion of ghosts biblically, it's like almost up to interpretation of like which Bible you're using,
right?
How your culture like interprets these things,
the
to
translation.
Be.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like iffy because like this is going to be a controversial take. I might get torn apart from this one.
Lay it on me,
man. I really grew up in a Lutheran church. A lot of practices that are now considered like Wiccan or like it's essentially it's prayer.
Yeah.
It's calling on an entity to help you. Mm-hmm. Like whether that be a god, a saint, like it's similar. And I know to a lot of people that's a controversial statement, but if you're looking biblically at like what is divination, what is summoning a spirit, is it praying to a family member who's like communing, trying to talk, like that's why religion gets so iffy, because it's like y'all really mad about something that you kind of do too, you know? So that's kind of my hot take, my controversial take as someone who grew up in a very conservative church.
No, I definitely see the argument.
There's parallels. Yeah. And the church was not willing to look at itself in that way at all. But the Bible has so many mentions of it, but it's like, what you really looking for here?
Right.
And then they start doing, you'll talk about it, but like they start talking about, oh, the physical aspects.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that's where anti-Semitism comes in. So
Yeah. Oh, remind me not to forget, because right now I haven't done any of like the look part of it.
Okay.
So remind me to do that for next week. Because I think that's really, it's later into the witch craze that we really see those type of stereotypes
like,
and
you
come
can
out.
See it too, like physically in depictions and primary sources.
Okay. So we of course have like the practice of like basically what we could call medicine men and women throughout history has never not existed. Is he back in your lap?
He's curled up on my lap.
Oh, he's such a ham. so there's always been just kind of natural healers in certain community groups throughout history. That's never not been a thing. Because of, for most of that history, people don't really understand medicine and germ theory and
it's crazy.
And how people are sick and how people are healed. That is kind of often taken as this person has some sort of divine gift on how to heal if they understand the practice of healing people. And you kind of see that traditionally passed down in a lot of families and stuff. And as they, you know, pass, you know, okay, I'm going to teach my kid how to heal people. And then that person becomes a healer and, you know, go on and on from there. And most of that is just trial and error and that knowledge that's been held throughout the generations and built on. So you see, you know, like a healer might be really great because, oh, yeah, my grandma had to deal with this. And now I know what works, you know.
Right.
So I'd. Like that form of what, you know, would later somewhat misinterpret into being a witch has always existed. It's never non-existed. But it wasn't until around the 1300s that we start to see people kind of become suspicious of that ability in people. We also see throughout, I know in England and like the UK in general, but probably throughout Europe, the practice of being a cunning woman, which is essentially a woman, mostly a woman, but it could be a whole family of people who practices, for lack of a better term, kind of like white magic. So they're healers. They just know certain things. They're able to kind of like, you know, maybe you do want to talk to an ancestor. You're able to help them like communicate with that. But it was never like seen as a bad thing up until like the witch trial craze took over. And an important thing to keep in mind as we move through kind of the whole period I'm going to be talking about today, which is like 1300s through 1600s, a lot is happening in Europe at that time. We have
namely one particular thing.
There's one really, actually two really big things.
That's true,
things.
I guess. There's a couple, but there's one that I know you're going to you're about to name drop.
The first really big thing is the Black Plague.
Yeah. Europe dies.
Yeah. And the second really big thing is the Reformation. These two things are happening.
Which I need to note this.
Yeah.
The day we were recording, do you know what today is?
Is it a Reformation
Day? It's Reformation Sunday.
Yeah. Wow.
It's Reformation Sunday. Wow. The Lutheran in me was like, I woke up this morning, I was like, I know what day it is.
Oh man, that's,
which, that's actually ironic. Yeah, it is Reformation Sunday.
Yeah. Hey, your birthday was yesterday, so everyone say happy birthday to Kat.
Thank you. I actually, there's a date that falls on October 29th in my story, but I realized I think it's the Salem part of my thing, which is next week, and I was like, oh, so close.
Dang.
But now I'm like, okay, my birthday is now the Salem Eve. I'm just calling it Salem Eve.
There you go, that's good. You have, like, your birthday, Salem Eve, then Salem Day, and then, like, one day later you have...
have, like, Halloween.
You have, like, Halloween Eve, which is already All Hallows Eve.
Yeah. And then you have... and then Halloween. I'm just going to make my... My birthday is now the spooky week.
There you go.
I'm just going to, like, commit to the every year.
I think that's a really, yeah,
honestly, I'm kind of vibing option. With it. Yeah. It's not like having a birthday before Christmas where you lose it on, like, presents and festivities. Like, it's still mine.
It's
and I get
chill.
To mooch off of everyone else's Halloween festivities
exactly.
and vibes.
Exactly. And you're like, yeah, this is...
It compensates for the vibes.
And you can always, like, your costume can always be like birthday girl or something like that.
Oh my god, that's so good. I never thought to do that.
Get like
I
a
never
sash.
Thought that.
Yeah.
It's so nice though because like I don't have to get anyone else in the celebratory mood. They're already
down.
Every day is a vibe.
Yeah. 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 Hey, I say embrace it. That's awesome.
I don't ever like tell anyone that though. So like I walk into work and like they know, but they're like, do we say anything? And it was, like, such a crazy day at work because I had parades and all this stuff yesterday. I worked my whole birthday. And, but, like, everyone else was, like, I don't tell anyone, so I didn't have to deal with any of the awkward, like, things.
Yeah.
I got to just play it low-key.
Yeah.
Yes.
No,
Reformation Sunday. Reformation's
no, we're allowed
going
to take
on.
Time
yes.
to say happy birthday to Kat.
I appreciate it.
So we have two really major events, not to mention that just kind of in general throughout Europe, we're seeing a lot, but what's really new, we're seeing a lot of religious conflict, a lot of Christendom is kind of like really solidifying its hold throughout the whole continent. And with that kind of becomes like, this is the norm and this is other.
Mm-hmm.
And those other practices become demonized as Christianity moves towards being the norm.
Yeah.
And then when you have major events, and also there's a little ice age happening in Europe at the time.
That's true.
Which causes, not consistently, but like pretty consistently, not every year, but like every little while, a dip in the temperature is enough to like ruin crops and cause famine. And you actually do see, if you kind of look at what year the crop was the worst and what year the witch trials happened the most, guess what? They're the same years.
The plague song for Prince of Egypt just came onto my head.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
And then, of course, we have the Black Death, which, as Kat so succinctly said, Europe did essentially die, where a quarter to a third of the European population unfortunately died during those years in the 1340s and early 50s. But that kind of left a lot of people understandably kind of disillusioned and looking for basically a place to put the blame. And while they put the blame on a lot of different places, the people who they would eventually decide were consorting with the devil were kind of a big scapegoat on, well, you are messing around with evil things, so you must be the reason why this evil thing happened to us. So we have a lot of kind of cultural factors interacting in this moment to basically create the witch craze in Europe during these years.
It's really interesting to see, because I'll talk about it too, like the context in which hysteria grows, And there's a couple similar things, you know, like hunger and disease and stuff. But there's a couple other factors too that are like are not present there that is very interesting to me.
Yeah. So we see, as I said before, we see Christianity kind of solidifying its hold on its on the continent. And with that, they have to determine what is Christian and what is not Christian. And then they have to somehow ensure that what is not Christian is not still practiced. And with that, we see the rise of the concept of heresy and people being punished because of supposedly heretical actions. And this ultimately is just kind of whatever the church deemed was heretical, deemed was not in line with the Bible. And, you know, people, anything really, just, okay, you're a heretic now, you know, just kind of,
I used to do whatever I want with that label.
So we see kind of heresy take over at first, and we see, we do see in the 1300s, some just specifically witch trials happening throughout the continent, mainly in France and Germany at this early stage. But these aren't, this is not at the point yet where witchcraft is connected and seen as an act of heresy. Witchcraft still is something they don't like, something that's illegal to do, but it's not yet heretical. It's not yet against the church to do witchcraft at this point.
It's just like heavily frowned upon and might get you stoned by like the village, but not like the church leaders.
Right. It's like if you commit murder, that's not heretical, but it's
vigilante justice might come for you, but the government's not.
It's not like, the church is not going to burn you at the stake for murdering someone, but you will get put in prison and probably hanged. So, you know,
it's a mob will chase you off.
That's kind of like witchcraft at this point was just a crime, not necessarily a crime against the church. And it's like that up until really the late 1400s. We do see kind of like some of our beginnings of ideas about witches kind of start to bubble up in this early time in the development of the witchcraft craze. So we see kind of like, okay, witches meet. I talked about this a couple episodes ago when I looked at Alice Keitler. Is he on your lap
cat
again?
Is tree leg hugging me while I try to stretch with yoga.
Oh my goodness.
That was iconic.
Oh my goodness. I lost my train of thought.
Sorry.
You're good.
Appa's purring now. Appa does, for the listeners, Appa's not my biggest fan. But like right now, Appa is crawling all over me and purring.
He's having a special day, so I'm glad that he's not like scratching the crap out of you. So we see kind of the first ideas of like, okay, witches are organizing. They're having these meetings. They're forming what we would see as covens. The devil is not quite attached to them yet, but we do kind of see some stirrings of that. But it's just not like, it's kind of like the earliest ideas of like, hey, maybe like, the devil's involved.
Like evil, but not devil.
The devil himself. Okay. Yeah. So there's a few things that kind of are stepping stones into the big witch craze that we kind of, as we imagine it today. I can hear him purring over here.
He's straight up on my lap now.
Oh my goodness. One was, so Pope John the 22nd, who was around from 1316 to 1334, established the idea of, quote, heretical fact, which allowed heresy to be viewed as a deed and not just an intellectual crime. So heresy at that point was something that you did and not just something that you, like, in theory is bad to do. And this, again, eventually will pave the way for witchcraft because you were doing witchcraft, so it would eventually be connected to heresy. I'm glad you're having a good time over there.
Appa loves me now.
We also see, and again, right after this is kind of put forth, we have the Black Plague, and that obviously took over most people's attention. And after we are coming out of the Black Plague, we see the number of witch trials rise. And around the end of the 1300s, we kind of are hitting, like, this is becoming a trend. This is, we are now doing things like hiring inquisitors and establishing inquisitorial procedures.
This is standardized.
Yes, we're standardizing it. We're also removing penalties for false accusations of witchcraft. So now, so now anyone can kind of accuse indiscriminately without having to worry about any sort of repercussions on themselves. And this is how by the 1420s already we are seeing some of the first full-blown witch hunts. The first witch hunt that is kind of generally seen as the first one is happens in Switzerland. It's like the Switzerland/France, the Valais region. And it eventually spreads to the German-speaking Valais region.
Honestly, didn't think it would start in France and Switzerland.
You know, the French are kind of like that. So.
Yeah, but Switzerland?
Yeah.
They got a reputation. Well, they're not there yet.
I was going to say, yeah, it's a couple hundred years before. Plus, this is like the French part of Switzerland.
That's true.
So,
that's true.
You know.
They had to prep for all the revolutions.
Yeah, yeah. So this starts in 1428, and it's kind of unclear how the craze started, but it ends up with at least 367 people being put to death on accusations of witchcraft. And this is what's interesting about this is it's so early that we don't actually have they don't have the concept that women are more likely to be witches. So we see in this early trial that it was about half and half accused and that were put to death, which is really interesting to me because it shows you just how much the whole witchcraft craze was just kind of social ideas and passing along and just kind of existing in the culture.
Are you going to talk about like why women?
Yes.
Okay. I was curious because I was like, I can talk a little bit about it, but it was not in my original notes for today.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. What was interesting about this is this specific, how they handled this witch trial was that if one person was accused of being a witch, all it took to verify that accusation was three different neighbors of that person had to verify, yes, they are a witch.
So don't piss off your neighbors.
Yeah. So this led, unfortunately, to 367 people dying. And again, that's like the first witchcraft trial that we see on a mass scale like that. This also stories and kind of like testimony, I guess you could say, were collected from this and some of the other very early witch trials, and were collected by authors and theologians and became kind of the first set of writings on witchcraft and what witchcraft was. And so now we're seeing it kind of academized, you know, it's becoming not only is it becoming part of the legal and judiciary systems and people in places,
like research,
and now it's
that,
research
that credibility
legitimized
society. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Which is funny because like nowadays to be credible you have to have like a million peer resources and to show your work and use certain technology and and people are like, oh, this dude from this university wrote about it. You're so right.
Yeah. So even Joan of Arc herself was initially accused of witchcraft, and although they eventually dropped the witchcraft charge and eventually just went with good old heresy.
I was about to say, they kind of got what they wanted anyway.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I do think, though, that if she had happened 100 years later, kind of in the height of the witchcraft, like, craze, I think they would have ran with the witchcraft and not
probably.
The heresy.
Probably.
Yeah, because
she probably would have died a lot sooner and younger.
So it hurt, even though she was pretty early on in kind of, like, the cultural phenomenon of witchcraft and everything in Europe, she still did not miss it, and it was still around enough for even her to get accused of it. Then as we see the culture and the literature and everything form around it, we see the writing of the book Malleus Maleficarum, which was last episode, I think.
Last week,
I'm really glad I took the time to talk about that book separately because it is kind of single-handedly the thing that creates the witchcraft craze in Europe. And this is where we, for the first time, see the idea and concept that women were somehow more susceptible to being a witch than men were. And while men could be witches, it was women that were weak-willed and more prone to the influence of the devil.
I did, during my research today, I don't know if you said it you might have mentioned it last week, but the stat may have not stuck in my head, that the Malleus Maleficarum was the second... did you mention that last week?
I didn't mention that specifically, but I know what you're going to say.
That it's the second most sold book in Europe during this time, only behind the Bible.
The Bible.
For years.
Yeah.
Which tells you a lot. Because that's a very human thing, by the way. Like, that the two things you value most are your religion and then hurting the people, demonizing the people that are not part of your religion.
Right. So, this book is kind of referred to as the textbook of the Inquisition. And it is essentially a handbook for how to deal with witches, how to identify them, what causes them, where they come from, and most importantly, how to extract a confession from them, and then eventually, I don't think they detail explicitly how to, what's the word? Execute them. There we go.
I was
I, if you're more interested in the Malleus Maleficarum, I did do a whole episode on it. It's the one before this one. I would recommend listening to that because it, I get into detail about like what the book is, how it came to be, all of that good stuff. But what you need to know is basically what I just said. It was the kind of cultural moment that skyrocketed the witchcraft from just being like, hey, maybe that's something weird happening over there, to being like, oh, this is a continental European issue. Not to mention, too, that the printing press, much like with the Reformation, came around at just the right time to allow this book to kind of explode.
Which makes me wonder if the printing press had come around 100 years earlier or later, what books at that time would have just exploded.
Right. So that's why we see this book kind of gaining the traction that it does. Much to the, to be clear, I mentioned it in the episode too. The Catholic Church does not, ultimately does not end up sanctioning this book. They do initially, and then they're like, oh, no. But by that point, it was too late. And the kind of, the culture, it had entered the cultural zeitgeist, and it was seen as kind of like the book and the knowledge, the, you know what I'm trying to say, the whatever, the source of information on witches and witchcraft. a lot of its argument on why women specifically was because, quote, witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in women insatiable, which is another concept that we talked about last episode. But for a lot of history, we see the concept in culture that women were the ones that were the corrupting force, and men were the ones that needed to be kept pure, which is reverse of kind of our conception of history that we have really from the modern period forward. But it does, you do see this being a really big reason why so many women specifically were targeted for this. Another really interesting thing too about like why women specifically is that there's a pretty big social shift happening in the lives of women in Europe at this time. The typical marriage age was rising and a lot of women weren't marrying at all. That means that anywhere from 2 to 3/5 of women between the ages of 15 and 44 were unmarried.
Whoa.
And then not to mention that
for that time period, that's way higher than I thought it would be.
Not to mention that women were increasingly able to find growth as cities were growing throughout Europe. And we see the growth of kind of some pre-industrial labor markets. We also see the practice of midwifery growing as women gain more independence and, you know, birth control and different family planning methods, I guess you could say, were on the rise. And as we know, society tends to freak out anytime women gain a sort of agency. And so this kind of coinciding with the witchcraft craze and the refocus on women as the target for the influences of Satan, because they're somehow, they're more, you know, they're more independent now and they don't have a good man to keep them out of Satan's grips.
So an independent woman is, you know.
Yes.
Obviously a very devilish dangerous thing.
Yeah. Very dangerous. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, all of those factors are kind of why women. We also see specifically old women being targeted for witchcraft because they were widely single. Not all of them, but it was mostly single old women. Single elderly women were a big chunk of those targeted. And the thought is, too, that as conditions worsened during a little ice age, the old women were kind of seen as the weakest link in society and an extremely large burden to care for and to feed. So if you create hysteria that allows you in good conscience to eliminate the weakest links that you have to care for, then, you know, then you don't have to feed your old grandma because she's a witch. So,
turn 80, suddenly become a witch.
Yeah.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah. So, the Malleus Maleficarum is published in 1485, I believe it is, or 84, I forget. But it doesn't take long for that itself to kind of grow in popularity. He's just looking around. Yeah. Cat has my cat on her back, and he's just hanging out up there. And so we identify at the peak of the witchcraft craze in Europe as being between 1560 and 1670. This period would see more than 40,000 deaths throughout Europe, all related to witchcraft accusations.
That's like a crazy high number, because if you think like, oh, they were trying to eliminate dependent members of society, like, okay, you killed like one or two older women, but no, like 40,000 people is a marked diminishment of society, especially if you're talking about like small areas and villages that are really hurting for food and resources. Like, that's just such like a higher number than America that for some reason I just never processed how many people that is.
And to me, it's really like, you know, people are always ask about why. Why?
Here.
Why did this kind of take over? And people really ask it about Salem, because that happened in such a bubble. But it's true. It's like, why did it happen throughout all of Europe? And I think it's because it's a lot of these anxieties. A lot of them just kind of collected into one. And all of a sudden they had something to blame. And as soon as they had something to blame, it took over and it became part of the culture. And so you saw whole communities basically, without meaning to, it seems, banding together and just kind of like
mutually deciding.
It's like mutually assured destruction. It like, So why were people accused? People could be accused for kind of anything, as we said earlier. It really didn't matter what they did, because people, the Malleus Maleficarum also encouraged the idea that instead of kind of the innocent and proven guilty until proven guilty concept that we have now in our judicial system with witches. And they had that concept too. That was how they handled everything else. But for witches, it was, you are guilty if you were accused, because according to God, or like, God would not let an innocent person be accused of witchcraft.
Which is really ironic.
Yes.
Seeing that like most of Europe just died a little while ago and not all those people could have been guilty of terrible crimes.
Yes. So if you were going, if you were operating based on the stance that you are literally, if someone says, hey, that's a witch, then you're a witch, you're going to see a lot of deaths. And if you're going to take that seriously, then that's where we get these really drastic numbers. And which is why it could be literally anything that people were accused of. If someone's housemaid came home a little bit too late, then you can accuse them, oh, you were at a coven meeting, I know you're a witch, you know? And
you
it happened.
Actually with your husband.
Or maybe it was that. Maybe you're the lady of a house and you know that your husband's having an affair with the maid, and she comes home a little bit too late one night and you want to get rid of her.
Yeah.
That's a witch.
Yeah. And it's a foolproof way to do
that. And it's a foolproof way to do that.
Or like, hey, give me all your money or I'll call you a witch. Like,
yeah.
Like it's, yeah. It creates like an authoritarian, almost like a police state of people. It does.
Yeah. And it's a lot of, there's a term for that when it's like people.
I know. And I can't think of it.
It's like a surveillance state, but it's like within each other.
I know. I don't know the official name for it. The closest I could come up with was community police state.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. If you know it, let us know.
Yeah. Tweet at us.
Yeah. So, because people talking a lot about it now with like social media about how we're doing a surveillance state on ourselves. Anyway, it could literally be anything, but what we see emerge as kind of the most consistent signs that someone was a witch was the presence of several different things. One of the most prominent was a devil's mark. Which was some sort of, it literally could be anything on your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And, people have marks and scars and everything on their skin now.
Yeah. So many.
And that's not like in 1536 when, when, you know, you had like blisters or, and the pox.
Imagine,
and like,
yeah. Imagine yeah. that someone came up to me and was like, hey, your acne scars, it's the devil's freckles.
Right.
And I'd be like,
so it could be a mole, an age smart a spot, a birthmark, like literally just natural occurrences on people's body.
I do have one that I am kind of proud of that it's weird. It oh, yeah. could be interpreted as a devil's mark. Oh, yeah. If I was here, I have reflective freckles.
Oh.
I have a freckle right here, uh-huh. and I have a freckle right here in the exact same spots on both sides of my body in there multiple places. Like it's weird. It's like odd symmetry. Like it is like not natural. Like it's kind of weird. And I like to think that if I had not liked to think actually, because it's not a good thing, but uh-huh. I definitely would have been, they would have been like, look at her. She's too symmetrical. The devil's been there.
No lord of mine would let someone be so symmetrical.
No one gets symmetrical freckles.
So these devil's mark were seen as, it was thought to be a lot of different things that kind of caused them. It was like a sign of your allegiance to the devil. He would mark you. Others said that it was like your familiar would like suckle on you, in that location. And that was like one of the things that caused a devil mark. I don't know. They came up with that crap and it wasn't real, obviously. There was also a lot of different methods to kind of test if someone was a witch. And basically these were like a catch-22 things. One of the most prominent or popular ones was the swimming of the witches, which was, you know, hey, put them in the lake. If they drown, they're not a witch. Mm-hmm. And if they live, then we're killing them anyway.
Yeah.
And so it was just, there was really no rhyme or reason to it. Any sort of healing activity, any sort of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, as we said before, any sort of anyone who had a reason to get you and was out to get you,
mm-hmm.
anything could have been. There was no, and things varied. It was all of Europe, right? So things varied from region to region. What was kind of the most popular way that people were being accused in somewhere like Estonia was very different than someone in France getting accused of witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of that being said, I'm going to kind of finish up my first part of this by looking at a case study of one of the biggest European witch hunts that happened during the height of the witch craze in Germany. So this was in Bamberg, Germany, and it happened from 1626 to 1631.
Okay.
Not only is it one of the biggest witch trials in history, it's also one of the biggest mass trials and mass executions ever seen in Europe. Just as some history, we're going to kind of start with Bamberg and the history of the town itself and how it relates to witchcraft. They seemed kind of slow on the uptick on kind of the whole witch craze.
Okay.
It was actually not until the late 1500s that we see someone being like, okay, I'm gonna allow witch trials in the diocese. So Prince
you said Bishop, in the diocese, like through like the church itself.
Yes, this is a Catholic like, area. Yes.
Okay, instead of yes. like the village, like
yes.
governor. Okay.
Yeah. So Prince Bishop of... Oh, and that's another thing I wanted to say. A lot of the articles were like, honestly, like, we have the Reformation happening at the and this point too. And so, like, the question is like, are Protestants or Catholic more... who's accusing which is more?
Responsible of which,
and yeah. It's honestly, like, there's... It's just such a cultural thing that there's no difference between the rate at which Protestants or Catholics accuse people of witchcraft. Oh, and I don't think I mentioned this, too. It was the Malleus Maleficarum. One of the most important things it did was it was the first thing to... And I know I mentioned this in the episode on it, but I wanted to mention it again here. It was the first thing that officially connected witchcraft to heresy. Witchcraft became a heretical act with the Malleus Maleficarum, because Malleus Maleficarum is kind of the first thing that we see connect... witchcraft to specifically devil's work, and that people are in league with the devil himself, aka going against God.
Yeah.
And that is an act of heresy. So, so we're in Bamberg, Germany, which is a Catholic area. Prince Bishop of Bamberg, Natard von Thungend. And was
phenomenal.
Thank you. Was the first to allow witch trials in his diocese. But he was like, he was a Catholic bishop in Germany in the 1500s. So he had other things on his mind.
kind of busy right now.
Yeah. One of his successors, Johann Gottfried, did allow, once kind of the Reformation in the late 1500s going into the 1600s, once the Reformation kind of chilled out, the craze kind of caught up with Bamberg, and this bishop, Johann Gottfried, allowed for trials to happen within the diocese. And it kind of was popular. There was one trial that he allowed to happen that actually everyone knew grew out of a family quarrel. And it led to several people being accused of witchcraft and 15 people being executed out of like a family fight. So again, we see it's just kind of like indiscriminate. Yeah. It doesn't matter where it comes from.
Okay.
Then we see a bigger round of accusations and prosecutions came in 1616 after some crops failed. And it actually, we see a pretty significantly low dip in temperature right in the 1560 through 1670 years of when the craze was at the highest. So that's a really interesting correlation to me. Correlation's not causation, but there is a correlation there.
Worth noting.
Yes. Yeah. But so from 1616 to 1622 in Bamberg specifically, we have a total of 159 trials were registered, most of those unfortunately resulting in death. However, Counselor George Hahn, who is like city government official in 1622, was like, hey, we have to stop having witch trials because we are literally, it's the 30 Years War now.
We kind of got to stop killing our own people.
We have to... And spending money to kill our own people.
Yeah.
We have to spend that money and kill our own people in the 30 Years' War and not in the witch trials.
Radical notion.
Yeah. So that kind of tamps down the witch trials for a while until 1626, when Prince Bishop Johann George Fuchs von Dornheim,
who was
the Prince Bishop of Bamberg from 1623 to 1633. This guy, let's just say he had a vendetta.
he slighted.
Yes.
He jilted. Oh, he was. Oh, okay. Well.
Well, no, I don't know about that. But he had like a chip on his back. And he, I think, was specifically upset about the Reformation because Bamberg was very close to the Catholic Protestant border. And he was on a determined, he had this like mission to set out and make his diocese a godly state, and he wanted to make the population obedient, devout, and universally and absolutely Catholic. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Okay.
So he was determined to kind of clear out any sort of people who were heretical in the eyes of the Catholic Church. And of course, at this time, that meant
whoever they were witches. You want. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he had a theologian buddy, Friedrich Forner. And Forner really, like, I think they kind of fed off each other to create this idea that Bamberg was not religiously pure, and that the people of the city trusted healers such as cunning women and little women witches more than the church itself. And when you are trying to create a godly state and a, you know, that everyone follows Catholicism to a T, it's dangerous to have other sources of power, and you have to go after and try to deal with those sources of power, even if it was just, you know, someone who's a healer.
It's hard not to think that they might be shooting themselves in the foot a little bit, because, like, if you keep killing the people that are good at healing,
I know, and I'm like,
so good at it, how are you, like, you think it's magic?
I know, how are you? I my question about all of this has always been, how do you heal? How are you a healer in a godly way? Like,
yeah,
like, how are you not, in what situation are you appropriately healing someone?
Like, I guess they just wanted everyone to use prayer instead of, like, herbs or medicine.
I guess so. I guess they wanted nuns to do the same exact thing that, like, well, women on the street were doing.
Though there were a lot of, like, at this time, like, religious institutions. And that's where the whole thing about, like, the history of nursing comes from, about, like, women. We talked about it a little bit in the Florence Nightingale episode. Mm-hmm. That, like, the profession was seen as, in a lot of places, as undesirable, like nursing, because, like, it was something that was, like, people didn't want to do. Yeah. So the only people who would do it were, like, religiously devout ones, yeah, like nuns. So there were a lot of churches supplying these services because other people didn't want to do it. So, like, if you had a good healer,
yeah,
or a traditional healer, why would you want to kill them?
Right. Just make them be a nun.
Yeah.
Like,
I would rather, I guess, well, I can't say for sure. I'm not in that situation. But, like, I feel like I would rather become a nun than be murdered.
You know what? Me too.
I feel like that's the better option.
Yeah.
Whatever. You know, yeah. Not my decision, apparently.
So what exactly kind of ignited these specific trials in Bamberg, it's not super clear, because it was, the documentation is not as complete as we would prefer it to. We do know that in May of 1626, there was an extremely unusual frost that basically destroyed the entire harvest in the entire region. And we actually have some primary sources of people talking about how devastating this this frost was. The first one comes from a nun and a convert in Bamberg named Maria Anna Junius. And she writes that, quote, "A loud cry went up in the city. People were frightened to death as they awoke to find an unnatural night frost had killed off all the fruit trees, rendered the ground as hard as stone, and put pain to the grain harvest. Our prince, the prince bishop, was furious." And then we have a mayor of a town named Zeel, which was right outside of Bamberg. His name was Johann Langhans. And he says in his diary, quote, "The 27th of May, 1626, the grapevines all over Franconia in both bishoprics of Bamberg and Würzburg were destroyed by frost, as well as the dear corn, which had faded already. Everywhere around Zeel, everything was destroyed by frost, which had never happened in people's memory, and caused substantial princes to rise, whereupon an intense pleading and begging started among the common rabble, asking why the authorities went on tolerating that the sorcerers and witches are damaging even the crops. Therefore, His Princely Highness Johann George II, which is the Prince Bishop, was alerted to punish such evil, and therefore the witch persecutions started this year." So he's saying that, like, everyone immediately was like,
a witch.
The witches did this. And so the Prince Bishop, who was already looking for an excuse to get rid of these other sources of power that he deemed not Catholic enough, jumped on this opportunity. The first woman that we have record of being accused was a woman named Katharina Merklaren. She was arrested in November of 1626, and she confesses to having caused the frost by use of witchcraft. with her accusation and arrest, a special witch commission was organized to handle all of the witchcraft accusations, and they even brought in special prosecutors that were like deemed as experts from the surrounding areas. They used torture basically indiscriminately, and without any of the restrictions regulated by the Constituo Criminalis Carolina, which was the first criminal code of Germany. And they tortured people to confess to conducting and practicing harmful magic, to flying, to participating in a witch's Sabbath or a witch's dance, to having sexual intercourse with Satan or a lower ranked male or female demon, and having desecrated sacred objects. Once they had a confession on one or several of those topics, they went on to torture the people more, and they needed names of people who they saw also participating in witches' Sabbaths, which led to a lot of people getting accused, because if one person names three people, and then all of those three people name three people, and then all of those three people name three people, we have what is called exponential growth.
I was going to say it's a phone tree, but yeah, that too.
The arrests and accusations and then eventual arrests, because they arrested and basically charged everyone, mm-hmm. everyone who was accused. And this is, again, confessions under duress, so not credible at all. People just want the torture to end. The amount of people who were arrested grows so much that the Prince Bishop, by 1627, the next year, had so many people in prison that he had the area construct a special witch's prison called a Malefizhaus, or Drudenhaus, to jail all of the witches. And this
repeat the German word?
Malefizhaus, Malefizhaus. Huh. And that root, Mali, I think means bad.
Yeah.
Because I see it, it's malleus maleficarum. Like, it's
malicious.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, malpractice.
Yeah. Typical, not typical. Something unique that happened with this Bamberg trial is it got to the extent that people were accusing everyone. And this includes elites of the society. And the elite people were arrested and executed. This was not a normal thing to have happened. Usually elite society is pretty protected of accusations. But the witchcraft, like, I guess, indiscriminate. Didn't matter if you were super wealthy, super high up in the town, you were arrested. In fact, one of the most notable deaths from the Bamberg witch trials was, do you remember our friend George Hahn, who was like, hey guys, we have the 130 years war, we should do that. Well, Mr. Prince Bishop didn't like that the city official was not letting him kill the witches, so they were eventually accused, because basically everyone was accused. Him and his wife Katharina Hahn, his daughter Maria Ursula Hahn, and son Adam Hahn were all accused and eventually executed. When his wife and his daughter were first arrested in 1627, and he leaves with his son and to go to like basically a higher up power than the Prince Bishop, to be like, hey, this is ridiculous, like, this guy's going crazy over here, can you help us? And that person does say, like, oh, hey, yeah, no, that's not cool, y'all need to stop. But by the time they had returned to Bamberg in 1628, his wife and his daughter had already been executed. And they had named George and Adam themselves as their accomplices. And so then George and Adam were arrested and executed themselves. one of the people that George accuses, because again, they're just doing this in the hopes that the torture will end, is a man by the name of Johannes Junius, who is actually the father of the nun that we heard for earlier, or heard from earlier. And he writes his daughter from prison in June of 1628. In the letter, he says point blank period that he had declared his innocence initially, but was tortured. The torture was so brutal that he eventually had to confess his guilt, mm-hmm. and then name his accomplishments. So it just proves that, again, this is all done under duress. The mayor we also heard from earlier, of the town of Zeal, was himself arrested and executed. And even one of the earlier prosecutors was eventually turned against and arrested himself. Finally, in 1630, we see kind of the Prince Bishop bite off too big of a target. Because the problem with arresting and accusing and everything indiscriminately is that people have friends in high places. And these witch trials eventually end up accusing a woman named Dorothea Flock, who was from a very well-off merchant family from Nuremberg. And her family was not going to deal with her being accused and arrested and then executed of witchcraft. So they call on their connections to get her released. And the powers that be said, hey, you can't do that. The Prince Bishop, again, defies them again and resumes the case against Dorothea Flock herself. Which eventually means that the Pope himself was asked to intervene. So an imperial edict was issued by the Hofrat, which is like the German, German Catholic
council.
Yeah. When they learned about Dorothea Flock and what was happening to her. However, they were not fast enough and the Prince Bishop was not listening and Dorothea was executed on May 17th. After that, the problem of the ongoing, and this is a quote, the quote, problem of the ongoing Bamberg witch trials was placed on the agenda of the Imperial Diet of Regensburg on the 20th of September, 1630. This caused outrage among the leadership of the Catholic Church in Germany, who held the Prince Bishop responsible. And then an investigation by the Hofrat basically stopped any sort of any further trials from being launched. However, there were still people in prison. So those were so they couldn't start any more trials, but they could finish other trials. But our Prince Bishop friend, the theologian Friedrich Forner, dies in 1631. And people were finally, after 4 years of this, beginning to realize really no one is safe of this, and everyone, if we keep going at this rate, will be eventually accused. And so the people kind of turned against, they kind of came down from the high of accusing mm-hmm. everyone of witchcraft. And then eventually the Prince Bishop boss, the Emperor Anton Winter, who was generally known for his opposition to witch hunts, was appointed to become the new head of the Prince Bishop Witch Commission in Bamberg. So he takes over the Witch Commission. And that's when the Prince Bishop knew, oh, I'm fucked. And he fled.
Oh, no.
So under Anton Winter, all of the prisoners are released who are accused of being witches. So that kind of is the end to one of the biggest witch trials we see in Europe. Even though it happened, in not that long of a period of time. And it does seem that as soon as kind of the people who needed to know were alerted to what was going on, they did step in pretty quickly and take over the situation. However, it wasn't soon enough because estimates range that anywhere from 900 to over 1,000 people were accused and then killed of witchcraft in the Bamberg witch trials.
Oh my God.
In just 4 years, over 1,000 people. And that's like pretty weak record keeping because I don't think this guy was really listing out names.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm going to leave off for today. That's kind of a look at how it started and then a case study of like how an actual witch trial like happened in Europe and what that looked like for the people of a certain location. And we do see, instead of like a, you know, a countrywide witch hunt that we see with like, I don't know, the Spanish Inquisition. We see it pop up in these isolated communities, which is interesting because when you get into Salem, it's kind of like people are like, why is it just this one isolated community? But that seems like that's kind of how it happened for a lot of even the European witch trials, even though it was like more in like the culture as a whole. It didn't really reach that level of accusing 1,000 people and executing 1,000 people across the country. It was like these pockets where it happened. So anyway, that's it from me.
Nice.
Thanks. I felt like I got kind of rambly, but...
No, it was good. It's a topic that requires a lot of, like, detail and dissection, so I think you did a good job.
Thank you. And, you know, court history, which ultimately is what it is when you start getting into the trials itself.
It's a class thing.
It's not, like, my forte either.
but I really do think that there's... I mean, it's undeniable, and we'll talk about it a little bit in mine. It's undeniable that there is class issues with the witch trials, like, it's classism, it's competitive, Well, I just realized before I start mine, recommendations.
Okay, yeah, recommendations.
I have one.
What's yours?
Take like a nice warm, whether it's Epsom salt or like herbal bath or whatever, just take like a nice, if you can, nice warm, calming, soothing on your joints kind of bath or shower, because I always underestimate how much they help on like the first cold day. And for us, this is the first cold day of the season. Like, it was like a high of 80 yesterday, and then we went from a high of 80 yesterday to a high like a 45 today or something like that, because that's Texas for you. But I always forget how nice it is to just step into one after a long day. I don't have a bathtub, but I have a shower, and man, it's nice. It's relaxing. It helps your joints and your body. So that's my recommendation.
Nice. My recommendation is to watch Over the Garden Wall.
Oh, I love Over the Garden Wall. I love it. Yes.
This comes out on Halloween. And honestly, it can't, like, it, technically, like, the show takes place on Halloween. Technically, it doesn't really matter. It's more of just a fall show. So I fully believe you could watch it right up to Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So it's not too late. It's so fun. It's so cool.
I did watch something this week, but it struck work.
And I
liked it too. I'm like, dang it.
Yeah.
I can't wait till things aren't like that and then we can like promote things again.
Yeah, I know. We can talk about things. But Over the Garden Wall is over and done with. The guy who made it is like, no, I'm never going to make anything like that again.
Yeah.
So.
Although it's just great.
It's just great. And it's 10 minute episodes.
Yeah. It's very
short.
So
it's like literally movie length. So even though it's 10 episodes, it's very easy to watch and could definitely take you just under 2 hours. So that's what I recommend. It's so fun. So
very nice. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yawn. Very, very nice.
Oh man. I was like, okay, let me get into it. But no, it's you.
Yeah. No.
I just talked for too long.
So I will be talking today about the beginnings of kind of the witch trials in America. Just as a heads up, I will be stopping when I hit Salem, because Salem kind of is the end cap of America's witch trials. But probably the most well-known and prominent point of America's witch trials. So, unfortunately, a lot of sources that we have on early American witches are heavily influenced by the happenings of Salem. So even if we're looking at the pre-Salem time, the articles either mention them or compare them, and it's hard to get an unbiased kind of singular look because Salem is such an important case study and easily accessible case study.
Right.
So I don't want you to think that, you know, everything happened and Salem's most important part, but Salem's probably the most best, well-documented one that we have. So I just want y'all to keep that in mind. So in summary, the witch trials in America, especially ones that I'll be talking about today, were sort of a hysteria of accusations thrown around between the 1600s and 1700s. There were definitely subsequent deaths and ostracizations, not quite so bad as Europe in those numbers, but a lot of people's lives were destroyed by them. So yeah, if you aren't quite interested in the early stuff and you just want to hear about Salem, then go for it. Sorry, Appa was destroying Kaylee's mic box there.
He likes to do that.
But
he wants to make my life harder.
Yeah. So yeah, you can skip ahead. I'll be going first next week because I'll pick up right where I left off, just starting with Salem. So if you're just more interested in that, feel free to skip. I won't judge you. But the origins are important to understand. So as Kaylee was talking about, it's pretty hard to succinctly describe what a witch is, what they are by our standards and everything, because... Not you too, Fry.
Oh my goodness.
Because by at that time, someone practicing witchcraft or using spells or doing anything that resembled anything in sort of a pagan space could have been condemned as a witch. Just being different, honestly, was which also
just
unfortunately
being like an independent woman too.
Yeah, independent woman. But I also do want to point out that this is like really bad for people who are dealing with mental health issues.
Yeah.
Because visions are a big part of what could get people, like, things like schizophrenia.
Well, even, like, depression.
BPD, but depression. Anything that causes any sort of, like, manic feeling. Like, all of those things could get you in a lot of trouble.
Right, and if you can't get out of bed, then you must be under the influence of the devil.
The devil has taken your energy
from
you.
Yeah, let's look for a witch's mark. Oh, there it is.
There's the freckle.
It's been suckling at your teat.
Yeah, so basically, like, I do want to note that this is...
That's a good point.
Really affect people who are ostracized from society in ways that sometimes they can't even help.
It is very much an other.
Yes.
An other.
It's a
phenomenon.
Fear of the other.
It is. That's what I'm trying to say. The others are very feared.
Yeah.
That we can see with witchcraft. And it's in the origins too. It's like, how do we. It was in the freaking Bomberg trials. It was like, these aren't the Catholic Church. How do we get rid of them?
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
And especially, because I know this is a huge thing in Europe, you know, when you're talking about, like, what is a woman's role at this time? Like, marriage and children and what part of society are they supposed to contribute to? All of these are big discussions that historians have about women in this time. Because, unfortunately, due to media perceptions that we have nowadays, we have this idea that women are literally only, in this time period, only valued for the home and stuff like that. Which is true in some ways, and it's a bit of a hyperbole in others, but events like this in history that really demonize women who went out of the box in any way, shape, or form, it does a huge disservice to our perception of women.
Yes.
And women too, because if you're looking in colonial America, these are women who are, by nature of being in the 13 colonies, breaking the status quo. They're in colonies that at given points are in, like, open rebellion to the crown. They're, you know, they're
well, not to mention, like, when you are living on the frontier,
you don't get
you don't get to have gender roles.
Yeah.
Like, everyone has to work, you know?
Yeah, everyone's working, and there's class distinctions.
And that's really interesting, too, because it's, like, it's, again, it's fear of women gaining too much agency. And
but
we see that
by,
in Europe.
By necessity. In this context, need to have some level of independence. So this
but
is
people
that,
don't like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a really interesting way to look at, like, what do the witch trials really do to women's psyches at this point? It really pigeonholes them into this, like, okay, you're allowed to work. You have to work. You have to contribute to the family. You have to learn these trades that might otherwise, in Europe, be left to men. But don't do it a step out of place, because that can get you in a lot of trouble. And so it creates this standard for women to work within, and men too, because there were male victims of the witch trials in America. But as I was reading on this, that really struck me. I was like, this really really challenges women in the growth of America. This sets mm-hmm. the stage
yeah.
for what the role of women needed to be in America for right. a really long time, when otherwise, like the Wild West that we see a couple hundred years later,
yeah.
women in that freedom to have their own agency, like men flocked to women on westward expansion in right. America. In this case, there is an active force working against women's agency,
mm-hmm.
but they need that necessity. And later in like the Wild West, you don't see that as much. Women right. have, well, I mean, they've got fear of like diphtheria and cholera and everything like on their yeah. westward expansion, but they're not dealing so much with society's, I don't know how to say this, society's like perpetualizing what they have to do. It was more of a survival thing
oh, yeah.
on the westward expansion
yeah, yeah.
rather than we are setting up here in mm-hmm. a community large enough to standardize how you must act.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyone who breaks these ideals it's easy to just say, ah, a witch. They're working against the good of the community, which is really, in the colonies, that broad perception. Evil is just someone who wants to break the status quo and mm-hmm. ruin that communal peace.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, witchcraft is associated a lot with natural forces. Plant-based healing, rainstorms, natural disasters, events that can't be explained anything that would be out of the realm of control for humans and leans into a supernatural ability. And of course we need to look at derogatory implications of this, like doctors who combine or who I have to be really careful how I say this because cultures view this very differently. The concept of witch doctors
uh-huh.
and stuff. And keep in mind, America is not a separate sphere at mm-hmm. this point. You have, for a group of colonizers that are coming from Europe, they're about to get hit real hard with other cultures.
Yeah.
Both indigenous, mm-hmm. Enslaved people who bring culture with them. And even if they try to stamp it out, it starts to mesh and coexist with their own. Like, they're about to get kicked in the face real hard with concepts they don't understand.
Right, yeah.
And the idea of, like, I don't know if there's a like better term for the concept of a witch doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It's combining the supernatural with traditional.
Yeah.
And that's where that... like, where do you draw that line? If you're a Puritan in a colony and you've never seen a super type, like a certain type of medicine before, or you've never seen this plant before, like they're working yeah. with a whole new set.
Right.
Of-
and so it's all, and like I said too, it's kind of like, I mean, maybe by the time we're in America, we have a little bit better understanding of, you mm-hmm. know, medicine and, mm-hmm. and illness and stuff like
germ
that.
Theory, but
it's still, it still is a lot of it is very misunderstood and mm-hmm. people like don't have any idea
mm-hmm.
and so it is like I could definitely see, and because like, you know, your health
yeah
is so important to you
mm-hmm.
it is kind of seen as miraculous if yeah. someone's able to heal you,
and who's gonna go out there and test that plant first?
And exactly, like, and when it's a way that you've never seen happen before,
mm-hmm.
you can definitely be like, what did that person just do to me?
Right.
You know?
Like, did this work? Et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
Yeah.
And so we're dealing with misconstruing, like, oh,
and
it's
then
not-
if it doesn't work.
Right.
Then it's...
you curse them. You
yes.
them.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah.
And I know you'll talk about this probably a little bit next week, that there's a long link of how witches are depicted and described through xenophobia and anti-Semitism throughout mm-hmm. the years.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, in paganism is a huge accusation,
yeah.
which is funny because I'm looking at you, Christmas trees. Some Christians love pagan traditions. But especially women who are, like you said, showing ambition or intelligence or healing or medicine, it's hard because, like, you can't want to heal your child without mm-hmm. being accused of, like, selling your soul to the devil for
right.
doing it.
Right.
And
like, you know, your child was sick was the same thing as my child.
Why did yours survive?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I also want to note that you like, basically said it a second ago. When you're looking at a new world and a new context and a new plant and agriculture around you, you're gonna either hit or miss with these new healing medicinal properties and spices and herbs and poultices and tinctures and everything. But you know who already kind of knows that stuff? The indigenous people you're trying to colonize.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to play a huge role. Because I am...
And it's, again, it's like that power thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because I am talking about all of North America. And there is a very complex geography and explanations that is owed to the concept of witchcraft in early America. North America specifically. The word witchcraft itself comes from European colonization. So when we're talking about witchcraft, it's under that kind of that set of parameters. So is the concept of a witch hunt, but that doesn't mean that the idea of supernatural healing didn't mm-hmm. exist in indigenous groups already. In fact, it's recognized in many indigenous groups.
What we might call a witch, someone who uses supernatural forces mm-hmm. to heal mm-hmm. to,
which is prayer.
Yeah.
The same thing that a lot of Christians are doing under a different name.
Supernatural forces to accomplish a task. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
That is in every culture throughout the globe.
Yes.
But we could call that a witch, but like what we're talking about today is like the European witches.
Yes. Yeah. And so when you've got, there's like, I don't want to blanket statement this because I'm not educated enough about the detail to say that, but indigenous cultures, I don't know if it's every single one of them, but I know so many of them have concepts of like witches, but also in our perception, like the darker witches. If it's someone that is just upsetting mm-hmm. the balance, the communal balance and, mm-hmm. and trying to do evil against your community, then almost every society is going to have that concept under a different name.
Yeah.
And so among the indigenous people, it was a criminal act. I was looking at like a list of different tribes and how they see this and everything. That some of them had the concept of witchcraft punishable by death.
Yeah.
That it was sometimes, it seemed like in some tribes, more of a last-ditch resort. Like, hey, mm-hmm. like, you don't just outright kill someone for it. But mm-hmm. you know, responses vary. And this is, like, all cultures at this point, because we don't have things like centrifuges and blood analysis samples. To an extent, everyone is performing what we would now consider to be traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So when a group, when you don't understand the nature you are around and the things that you are working with, and the only people that do are indigenous, and you have to trust them. Like, you have to trust the people that you just screwed over so hard. you have poisoned them, you have, like, spread disease through their communities, and you need their help. But that help's gonna look a lot like witchcraft to you. You're gonna fear it. And it's just really interesting to me how that forms the colonial early American concept of witchcraft. Like, they're coming into communities that already exist and already have this concept under a different name.
Right.
Especially
because, like, you know, if we're talking the Pilgrims,
right,
they're coming over 1620s.
Mm-hmm.
Right smack in the middle of the height of the witch craze.
Yeah.
In Europe. So they're entering a place where, to them, the people are strange.
Mm-hmm.
The ways they heal and mm-hmm. practice that kind of thing are strange.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, they're already primed to be suspicious of healers.
Right.
Because of what's happening in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
We'll talk about it big in a mm-hmm. second, but yeah, you're 100% right. Like, this is the perfect
storm.
For hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's you're afraid of the other,
yeah,
the other communities, the other
mm-hmm.
like racial differences, and you're also afraid of the others in your own community, meaning you don't trust anyone.
Yeah.
And by nature, you have to trust these people, because otherwise you are stranded on a land you don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're done for.
Yeah.
So just keep all that in mind as we kind of jump into this. Okay. I did a little bit on, I had a little paragraph on Europe, because I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
What all you would talk about. We cover this, but I'll recap real fast. Obviously, Europe, it's way worse than what's going on in America. A lot more people are dying. It is standardized much earlier, but that means, like you said, all these people arriving in America have just come from, like, absolute hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
Europe, you know, you're really hitting it like late 1500s, 1600s. That's when all these people are starting to come over. And it, the demographics of which groups are migrating to which areas, colonizing which areas, mm-hmm. is going to affect this too. Because mm-hmm. someone from Spain yeah. is going to have a different take on witchcraft and how then freaked out they need
England.
To be. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you'll see that difference kind of pop up here and there. And you talked a little bit about the religious backing. We are looking at, in the American colonies, a lot of these are Puritan communities and very different perception of life and religion. Oh, kitty, hang in there. in places like Connecticut, religion is really emphasizing the prominence of the devil and that his presence is pretty much everywhere, that this is a daily threat to society that contains terrible danger. And I'm not saying that every single Puritan group, I mean, talk about like Puritans and Quakers and all those different religious groups all have a different take on the concept of evil and the presence. And even religions now debate, like, what does the devil's presence look like? Does it just mean sin among people? Does it mean a physical manifestation? Does it mean demonic possession? Like,
mm-hmm.
it's a very different concept depending on, even within mm-hmm. denominations, mm-hmm. they do not agree. Individual
oh, yeah.
churches have different takes.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to make that very clear.
Yeah.
Anything I say about, like, oh, this Puritan group does not necessarily apply to every Puritan group.
Right.
Some people were far more fire and brimstone. Some people were far more like, let's just get through this winter and just not all die, you know?
Yeah.
But this idea of the devil is here almost creates a work righteousness mentality, which if you went to church or not, or have ever heard about theology, works righteousness is basically like, if you do good things, you kind of get to heaven. Like if you're good people and you do what you can, like, you know, maybe bad things will abate.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, if something bad happens, it's the devil. There's nothing left
yeah.
to chance or fate.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Hey, it's really easy to, I get why people are like, that's the devil, because
yeah.
you don't have to worry about why did that happen.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have an answer.
Famine? Oh, maybe we should, it's not about planting our crops and cycling through them so we don't
the
strip
devil,
the soil.
Clearly.
It's the
yeah.
devil, you know?
Yeah. It's nothing we could have done about it.
Yeah.
yeah.
And it's really interesting because A, you don't have to worry about it, and B, it takes a certain amount of autonomy away from people.
Yeah.
And that's very, like, depending on who your preacher is, if they're one of the, oh, people are inherently sinful,
mm-hmm.
and you have no control, and life's a constant battle, a preacher can manipulate his people into believing whatever they want about this, about using disaster to control people. And, yeah, this is as much about theology as it is society. It's a very interesting mm-hmm. tactic.
It was also like, I don't, obviously, even though they are literally colonizers, it's hard to feel sympathy for colonizers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change the fact that these people are still in a very stressful situation of trying to settle a land in a
right.
European manner.
Mm-hmm. And they've got no clue what
they're
going to
find. No, like, they are. And so I can imagine where, like, being able to have those black and white, cut and dry answers
oh, yeah.
in a time like
it's
that,
comfort.
It's comforting. It's appealing.
And you got to
yeah.
fall back on one thing. What's it going to be? Your religion.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a big theological discussion about, like, what is religion? Is it something people create for comfort? Is
mm-hmm.
it more than that? Is it something ingrained further in society? That's an anthropological question at this
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
But things, like, that changes how you view, like, could we be better people? Would the devil plague us if we weren't? Or is the devil inherently, are we sinful and the devil will always have a presence in our community and therefore it is our moral obligation to get rid of witches, to try and purge the devil? It is a tangible thing we can get rid of and it is our duty. Like,
mm-hmm.
it changes, but it vastly informs the importance of the devil within each individual, hi kitty, each individual community.
Mm-hmm.
So, much like Europe, there is a point in which the colonizers are barely hanging in there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see quite the decimation of the Black Plague.
Mm-hmm.
We do not lose almost 3/4 of well, actually, I don't know the statistic, but smallpox has become a ravaging issue.
Yeah.
And I know the stats for it are insanely high.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and depending on what community you were in and how close you were to another community that might have been affected.
Yeah.
The stats vary on that, but there is famine as well. So disease, famine, et cetera, et cetera. The indigenous people are pushing back because they're obviously being colonized and murdered. And so they're facing exterior threats as well as interior. It also does not help that the French and British war has been waging, or the French and British have been waging King William's War at this point, which leaves the colonies reeling a little bit, and they need someone to blame. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, I don't know if we've ever talked about it very much on this. I think we did a couple episodes about during Indigenous history that might have mentioned this. King William's War
is probably when
William and Mary basically started a war with France in 1689.
And it's like a proxy war in the United
States. It really is. Yeah, it does some major damage to some of the American colonies in the north, and also up in Quebec, Nova Scotia, over in New York. And it sends a lot of people fleeing into areas around places like Salem Village, which at the time was the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And massive migration in itself doesn't necessarily cause this paranoia, but it definitely contributes, because all of a sudden these areas that are already kind of struggling to keep up with an influx and in starting new societies, the infrastructure is going to get stretched pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
They're tight on food resources, and tensions are also high between things like old money and new money. Mm-hmm. Which you don't really think about. You think like, oh, everyone's in the same boat. But at this time, we're starting to see some establishment in these colonies. Right. We have people who don't necessarily have to be in the field every day, and then people that do.
Well, not even to mention the people who are coming over to America because they're desperate for a job,
mm-hmm.
versus the people who are like, I have money and I'm going to go over to America to expand my wealth.
My fortune. Yeah. And people who have been in this colony for a long time and have been building up their resources and homes. And then all of a sudden, these refugees from up north are like, oh, shit, we got to get out of like mm-hmm. war zone. Are not going to be carrying all their precious China with them. Not that anyone had precious China. But,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
So it's creating class tension, which, yeah. again, is a huge contributing factor in the witch trials. And specifically for Massachusetts, I do want to note, I'll bring it up next time. There is Samuel Parris, a reverend who is ordained and displays a lot of personality traits in the Salem Village that are not necessarily favorable to everyone. He's kind of greedy and stuck in his ways and uptight, which fits a lot of our perceptions about the Puritan stereotype. But he'll play a very large role later, so in the Salem Witch Trials. But he's just a really good example of, like, things were changing in these colonies. He was the first one, I think, first ordained in the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Mm.
And so as we see the standardization of religion, it also creates tension, because there are some people that are like, I don't like this ordained pastor. And you can't just, like, oust an ordained pastor like you could, like, a man who was just standing right. in the pulpit for the benefit of his community.
Right.
And, but him himself, like a reverend who can preach, who has that authority to say, like, hey, everything going wrong in day-to-day life is the devil's work. And then we start to see, okay, here's the groundwork. Here's the paranoia. Here's the tension and standardization that's going to allow us to essentially start seeing witch trials, in Salem. And we will jump back to Salem next week. But for now, I'm going to go back to some of the other origins. So you've got all of these factors, pushing everything around, famine, disease, war, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And in Massachusetts, and I apologize now if I get dates slightly wrong, you know me in math, I tried to do all this in my head. The first accusations that we really see in America come from Springfield, Massachusetts. I want to note, this is the first accusations, not mm-hmm. the first deaths.
Mm-hmm.
They show up in Springfield, Massachusetts, that we have record of, in 1645. This is a husband and wife, Hugh and Mary Parsons, who make accusations against each other.
It's just like witch trial divorce court.
I know, literally. Someone was like, oh man, we came to America. I kind of don't like you right now. Let's just do what the Europeans do. Witch. Of course, the husband is found innocent.
Of course.
And Mary is later found innocent of witchcraft, but is then charged with the death of her child. I do not know if this was like, she was maybe like mentally unstable and killed her child like intentionally or if her child maybe died from a sickness and they didn't want to call her a witch, but they're like, ah, this is your fault for like not nursing them or something. I don't know. Yeah. I couldn't find good documentation like that I trusted on that, but she was sentenced to hanging for the death of her child, not for witchcraft, but then died in prison before she could be hanged. So technically did not die because of witchcraft, died in prison because of child death. So kind of, but not really.
Okay.
Then we hop over to Windsor, Connecticut. This is where we see the first documented American who was killed for the practice of witchcraft in colonial America. So this girl was named, let's jump a couple years after. That was in 45, the first accusation. The first to be killed was in 1647. Her name was Alcy Young, sometimes written as Alice, and she had one child while she was still alive who was named Alice Beeman Young, which is kind of confusing. He was born in 1640, 7 years before Alcy herself would be put to death. Just for ease of it, I'm going to call Alcy the mother, Alice is the daughter. Okay. There is a correlation between families, and we'll see that a little bit in Salem too, that like, it was easy to blame, like, oh, this child is a witch, and she hangs out all the time with her cousin, who must also be a witch. So you end up with, like, a lot of accused family lines.
Yeah.
That pops up a little bit. But, yeah, so Alcy has a child 7 years before she herself put to death. That one child later, in the 1760s, would be condemned for this very same crime, but not killed like her mother.
Okay.
So we actually know very little about this original trial and conviction and murder. We aren't even sure what evidence there is to like prove who Alice was married to or how the trial itself went. Records indicate that she was a resident of Windsor and that she was hanged in front of the meeting house, that like kind of communal space. Other than that, we don't have we don't know what evidence they had against her. We don't even have good, like, word of mouth on this or oral histories that help us at all.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of around that same time, we'll flip back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In 1648, a year later, there's a Puritan midwife named Margaret Jones who is executed as the first for witchcraft in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Somewhere between, and I want to be clear, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they got some higher numbers, not compared to the Europeans, but compared to everyone else, because somewhere between 1645 and 1665, they would accuse about 75 to 80 people who were practicing witchcraft, and about 13 women and 2 men are executed throughout that process. And this is earlier, you'll note, than Salem, but that's going on in Massachusetts Bay Colony. So that kind of like sets the stage for what would eventually happen in Salem. And I just kind of want to note that like all this stuff, yeah, it's the first or everything, but it's setting a precedent and it's allowing it to happen now in America as well as Europe.
Yeah.
Connecticut would see the first real brush with quote witches. There would, a trial would take place in 1697, about 5 years after Salem officially starts in 1692, but sometimes they get overlooked because their official trial doesn't start till a little bit after Salem does, even though it kind of like happened a little bit before / at the same time as Salem. All in all, during that 46-ish people were accused of witchcraft and 11 were actually killed for it, making the percentage per accused, the percentage killed is higher in this Connecticut trial than it was in Salem.
Gotcha.
It's just not always noted because Salem itself, the numbers are bigger. The percentages ratio is just smaller. Yeah. So, not every woman who was accused of witchcraft obviously ends up being killed for it. And the northern colonies aren't alone in this. England had criminalized witchcraft in 1542, I believe the year is. And the idea that witchcraft is a real intangible thing is very easily brought over into the colony at Jamestown in Virginia, and it plagues them daily in their everyday lives. Here, especially, it's really interesting because I don't know if this is noted. I found this noted in multiple articles because we have information of it, or maybe it was just happenstance. But I found that multiple sources in Virginia, because of their proximity, we have John Smith. We have some really like famous interactions between indigenous people and colonizers. So maybe that's why we have better documentation on this and it's noted more. But the Virginian Jamestown like areas thought that the indigenous people were straight up demonic.
Oh.
Like multiple times in their writings, we have primary sources on this that call indigenous people themselves demons. That their rituals and practices were demonic.
Of course.
Because racism.
Yeah.
It's derogatory. It really is. I was reading some of it and I was like, this is just, it's like ignorance. And it really shows you how ignorance is so easily, ignorance is really fear. They were afraid of these people. They were, they distrusted them. They were afraid of them. And they wrote then that they already felt like because of the proximity, they had to work with the indigenous people again, because you'll die if you don't.
Right.
But they, in a way, I think felt like Satan was already among them, you know, like
he's because already, they're already, well, and if they see them as Satan and they have to work with them, they're working with Satan and their conception.
Yeah. And that presence is among them. And,
and they've already allowed it in. And so it must be infiltrating into us now. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that really, it's really interesting to see like, I could talk all day about Pocahontas, about the fetishization of circumstance. Because when John Smith takes Pocahontas back to Europe, eventually she'll die of illnesses there because she did not have the immune system that was used to European illnesses, et cetera, et cetera. But to that, that was like a, both a political arrangement, but also like, from what I've understood about Pocahontas' history, he was very much like showing her off. Like, in a way, kind of like fetishizing this foreign exotic woman. And it's really interesting that when you want it to be, exotic is no longer demonic. Like, when it serves you, this is something cool and worth looking at rather than being afraid of. And I just want to note that, like, in no way is this a simple cut and dry, white people always thought indigenous people were demonic. Or all, like, they had their moments where they're like, oh, we need these people. We like these people. They saved our butts. Let's go kill them now. Like, you know, it's never that cut and dry and simple. But that context, that close proximity in those writings we have tell us that they were very much scared of the people around them. And that again, it means that you don't trust people in your community and you don't trust people around your community. And that's a very dangerous place to be that causes hysteria. So what's interesting about Virginia is that they did in some areas, especially the lower Norfolk County, they put protections in place saying that in 1655, false accusations were criminalized. Which is really interesting when they're that scared of like the presence of the devil and everything. And I would, I'm pretty sure that this was not in favor of like, oh, let's protect witches. Let's protect, you know, possible victims. It was just like, hey, we don't want to have to like deal with the hysteria.
Yeah, we don't want to sort through the bullshit.
So like we got to make sure that everyone's not just like.
Well, and it also gives them the. The kind of the go ahead.
Yeah.
Because if someone's accusing, it must be real.
Yeah.
It gives them the authority.
Assurance
to be like, okay, well, this must be real because
no one would fake this because we have,
you know, we told them not to, so they're not going to do that.
Yeah. And it's, to be fair, it is a notable, I don't know how many people would actually discourage. But if you falsely accused someone, you had to pay almost £1,000 of tobacco in a fine. And that's not
That's nothing.
Not small pennies.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And you could be subjected to a larger fine if you were, mm-hmm. if the court didn't rule in your favor. So I doubt this was really for to help protect women or witches or anything like that. It was probably just to prevent the utter shitstorm that was hitting the fan everywhere else from gaining that much momentum, because they were, again, very focused on, like, let's just survive.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, we don't need the BS of having to have trials and witch hunts and all this crazy stuff. Like, they knew there was a line. But all in all, in Virginia, there are probably something like 24 trials that we know of. But we do have records that there were some water tests administrated to... In the last witchcraft trial probably took place all the way in the 1730s.
Yeah.
So, like, we've got a pretty big span there.
Yeah. And I think in Europe, like, the last official one is, like, 1775.
Yeah.
But I'll talk about that
Sounds
next time.
Sounds
about
right. Yeah. In no way am I saying, though, that in Virginia the practice of witch hunting is, like, a fair trial. There was no, like, due practice. And one of the most famous stories from Virginia is that of Grace Sherwood, who was accused by her neighbors that she had put a spell on their cotton crop and murdered their pigs. I don't know if everyone just ganged up on this woman or what, but a lot of other people threw accusations her way, and they officially put her on trial in 1706. The test they administered to her is not only controversial, as Kaylee mentioned before, but incredibly unethical and basically murder, because mm-hmm. either way, you kind of end up losing mm-hmm. if you are accused.
Mm-hmm.
The water test had already been banned at this point in Europe because it was so controversial and unethical.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that Virginia, who was like, let's make, like, put legal, like, precedent here about not accusing stuff, they're the ones that were like, let's try the water trial. But
hey, I think it's just kind of like, whatever.
Well, and too, I saw some sources that were like, hey, these first big ones, like, there's a reason some of these people may have been chosen to be put on trial. Like, people wanted to make an example, show their power, like, mm-hmm. scare, like, other people who could be witches. Whether or not this first person was actually a witch or they believed it, they had to make a statement.
Right.
Like Kaylee mentioned, the water test is when you're tied up, usually bound at the hands and feet, and thrown mm-hmm. into water where you aren't able to swim. If you sink, you're innocent because the water is pure.
Yep. Yep.
The water is pure. So if the water accepts you and you sink into its depths, you're a pure person. But if you manage to float on top, it's because the water has rejected you as dirty and unpure and will not accept you.
And here's the thing about humans.
We are kind of buoyant. If you lay on your back, and I would like to be clear too, I don't want to blanket statement this, but, like, especially in colder areas in the wintertime, skirts and wool clothing can take on up to 10 pounds of water, mm-hmm. which is why it is, like, being a woman, like, petticoats and dresses were very dangerous around water. And mm-hmm. this is something that's, like, a really niche part of fashion history, but there's a reason, like...
Is it in Pretty Woman when she falls into the lake?
In the lake, And that's why, like, a lot of people were like, oh, she should be able to swim and get out. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, a colonial woman with heavy wool skirts and stockings and boots, that is an added multiple pounds. Mm-hmm. If there is any current, it is very easy to just get slipped, like, swept under the water, to get pretty thrown around and stuff. It's, like... The stats for death for women of drowning are actually really high, not because they couldn't inherently swim, but because that amount of clothing does fight against your buoyancy.
Yeah.
But, like, if you're a woman, then you've probably grown up hearing, like, hey, when you go down to wash your clothes at the water, here's how you float. If you get caught in the current, if you get swept away, here's how you float. Like, people know how to swim. You have to. You need to know how to swim in the...
It's a survival thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's a community thing.
She floats. Grace Sherwood does float when her water
Well, and here's the thing, too. If you're sinking, how long before, oh, you're good, you say?
Yeah.
We're finding the balancing time between your drowning and them pulling you out of the water? Like,
So it is kind of, like, crazy to me. She manages to stay afloat, and she is subsequently then, everyone's like, oh, a witch. A woman who can swim, a witch.
Mm-hmm.
She is not killed for it, but she is sentenced to the next 8 years in prison. It is a concern in Virginia, though, the threat of death was still there. So the accusations in Virginia itself were kind of coming up 1826 through 1730. So they're running pretty much the full gambit, but they're not like killing people the way the other colonies are. And it seems that the Virginia authority figures, even when convicting them, were just, like, not really, like, excited to kill people for it. They were like, oh, we'll convict you. We'll make an example. We'll put the fear into people and the fear of death and everything, but we're not actually going to do it to you, which is very interesting to me. And I wish I found some more documentation on why, but any documentation, whether that came up in a court transcript or a journal or a diary, we don't really have good documentation. I'll get into that in a second. But the last record of witchcraft that we have in this area was about 5 years before the English Parliament repealed the rules on witchcraft themselves. This was about 1730. Yeah, she was the last one in 1730. A woman named Mary was said to have been using some form of witchcraft to hunt down lost items and treasures. I guess people really didn't want to see a woman get wealthy.
That's such, like, a compared to, like, some of the other accusations that people have, like, you killed my daughter. And it's like, you found a coin under the cushions. You must be a witch.
It's like, someone's like, every time someone's like, Mom, where did I leave this? She's like, I don't know. You find it. I don't know. I'm not a witch.
are you calling me a witch?
What am I supposed to do? Unfortunately, though, while she was not killed, she was convicted in the last criminal case, and she was whipped 39 times.
Ooh.
Which is very, very brutal, especially the risk of infection and how debilitating that can be on your body if you don't have access to medicine.
Yeah.
You can break ribs that way. Like,
oh my God. And yeah. 39 times, and that's all on the back, and that goes deep.
I don't even know if it was all on her back now that I think of it. I didn't see that specified. True. And that can be also incredibly. Yeah.
No.
So it was in no means. Good. I'm not saying that, oh, just because they didn't kill people, they were good. Like, this is still brutal. This is still bad.
Still torturous punishment.
Yeah. And I wish I knew more about, like I said, why Virginia authority figures didn't seem to want to kill people, but we don't have as much documentation as we probably would, because what happens real big in Virginia about 100 years later? The Civil War.
Yeah.
And a lot of Virginia's court records from the colonial years are destroyed in the fire and fighting and chaos, so we don't have great documentation on exactly what the numbers we're looking at here. Some of its approximations and all that, but we're looking somewhere in Virginia, at least 24 convicted-ish, at least. Mm-hmm. Could be way more, could be way, like, yeah. So, that's kind of like the big stuff going on in early America that sets the precedent for what will become our episode. I'll open with Salem next week, and we'll get some dirty deets on all of that jazz. And then Kaylee will wrap up with kind of the general concepts and what came out of it in Europe and everything. And
yeah, it'll be good.
It'll be awesome. But yeah, that's a lot of murder for being different this week.
Yeah.
Unfortunate state of affairs.
Yeah, to say the least.
And I'll talk a little bit more about it if you're okay with it next week. I have a couple mentions, but like accusations.
I think
we have practicing witches all over the world. A lot of it's usually called Wiccan in, I think, American and Canadian in like the North America area. I know it's not standardized necessarily across every culture, but there are still people who face extreme persecution for these practices, or it is used as a scapegoat. And we'll talk more about that next week. But like, I just want to make it clear, like, this is not a done deal. Like, persecution of witches, death for witches is still a practice in some places. So I just want to make that clear. Like, we aren't taking light of the implications of it now. But yeah.
Whew. So I mean, this stuff, there's a reason why big topics like this we put off until we're like, we just gotta do it.
You gotta, and it's me and the ancient Mesopotamian cultures.
Yeah,
it was like 2 years before I dug into that.
Yeah,
and it took me like a month and a half.
Yeah, so ain't no time like Halloween to make you timely do witches, because it's just so much. And like, you could, and there probably is a podcast that you literally walk through every witch trial.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure. And that is, honestly, a lot of them, I was like, I could do a whole episode on this. I could do a whole episode. I could have done a whole episode on Bromberg, but I was like, I'll give the condensed version in this because I needed a case study.
Well, and two, is it, and that's part of, we talk about it all the time here, history versus a historian.
Right.
It's high school, like, learning the facts, repeating the facts, repeating the story, versus the eventual job of understanding history is to analyze it.
Right.
And here,
we're able to, by doing the more broad version of things for you, we're able to talk more about the cultural implications, how it sets the standard for the rest of the world. Yeah. So we encourage you to go listen to those podcasts for sure, but we want to make sure that we give you like a holistic look at them.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So,
yeah.
Okay, well.
We'll be back again next week with, obviously you already know, it'll be more history on the witches. And if you want to tweet at us at TINAHL podcast, you're more than welcome to.
Or if you want to email us, that email is thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. And you can leave reviews for us anywhere you want. We
really appreciate it.
It would be a nice little spoopy Halloween surprise.
Yeah. Every review.
Give me a little jump scare.
Huh?
It'll give me a little jump scare.
There you go. I was going to say every review is one more piece of candy that we can have. So
one more bag that I managed to get at Walmart for like $3.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, we'll be back next week and we appreciate you joining us this week. Just a reminder though, that this has not been
a history
lecture. Bye. Bye.